This evening, Exodus chapter 32, verses 15 to 35. We considered the first 14 verses of chapter 32 last Lord's Day evening and drew from them the lesson of the primacy of faith in salvation and in life. Israel did not have faith. She did not know or trust the Lord, Yahweh her God, and her want of faith was the explanation of what she did in rejecting the Lord and turning to the idols of her time and her place. Her behavior, in other words, was the inevitable consequence of her unbelief. Now we proceed with the narrative and take up the consequences of Israel's idolatry, beginning to read in verse 15. Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back. This is the only place in the Bible where the fact that the tablets were written on both sides is noted. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. The emphasis on the divine origin of the writing is important, of course, for what comes after. When Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, "There is the sound of war in the camp." Now remember, in 24:13, in the last narrative section preceding this one, in fact, you can put the narrative sections right together and, as it were, omit all of that liturgical material between them, so far as the narrative is concerned. We were told that Joshua had accompanied Moses for part of his climb up the mountain. Apparently, he too had remained on the mountain all of this time, and Moses had collected him on his way down. Joshua, being a military man, immediately associates so great a tumult with battle. Moses replied, "It is not the sound of victory. It is not the sound of defeat. It is the sound of singing that I hear." Moses is obviously citing a poem already familiar that serves as a response to Joshua's concern. Remember, Joshua had not been in on the conversation that the Lord had had with Moses about what was happening at the foot of the mountain. And so Moses tells him it isn't victory, it isn't defeat. That is to say, it isn't the sound of battle as Joshua had thought, it's something else entirely. When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, his anger burned, and he threw the tablets out of his hands, breaking them to pieces at the foot of the mountain. The situation, as Moses observed it, was even worse than the description that the Lord had given to him on the mountain. The Lord had told him that Israel had made a golden bull, but Moses was not prepared to see the cavorting, no doubt some sort of fertility rite is being enacted, the reveling in their idolatry. Moses, if you remember, had been all of this while enjoying the most intimate communion with God that ever a man was privileged to enjoy. He'd been enjoying what would later come to be called the beatific vision. Suddenly, to be faced with this crude idolatry, this offensive paganism, was more than he could bear, something to take note of. It is some index of our holiness, of the sensitivity of our heart to the glory of God, how we take the paganism that is all around us. These people were not to be given the extraordinary divine gift that he bore in his hands, and in his righteous indignation he broke the tablets. But it's not simply an act of unrestrained anger. It's a ceremonial action as well. The breaking of the tablets on which was written a summary or an epitome of the covenant between the Lord and Israel meant that the covenant had been broken by Israel's sin. Moses was acting on Yahweh's behalf to indicate that the promises God had made to Israel were now forfeit because of her sin. Yahweh was abrogating the covenant that he had made with his people. It wasn't the tablets that were shattered in the first place, but the Lord's relationship with his people. And he took the calf they had made and burned it in the fire. Then he ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it. Making them drink the gold dust was intended to impress upon them the utter powerlessness and futility of the idol they had made. It was, as it were, a demonstration of complete impotence. Compared to the God who parted the waters of the Yam Suf, the idol is less than nothing, the grit in our drink. The breaking up of idols, by the way, is something that was already required in God's laws. We read in 23:24. He said to Aaron, "What did these people do to you that you led them into such great sin?" One look at his brother's face had told Moses where the blame lay. But Moses was at least willing to believe that Aaron had acted under pressure. "Do not be angry, my lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who will go before us.' As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt," again notice the complete absence of any sense of the Lord's presence, "we don't know what has happened to him. So I told them, whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off. Then they gave me the gold and I threw it into the fire and out came this calf." It's worth remembering that according to Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 20, it was only Moses' intercession that saved Aaron himself from execution. Moses saw that the people were running wild and that Aaron had let them get out of control and so become a laughingstock to their enemies. Now, the NIV's running wild is literally let loose. That is, loose in the sense of unbinding or letting loose long hair that's been held up in a hairdo. They're letting their hair down, as we would say. Here, the sense is of letting loose their inhibitions in an orgy. Bad morals are the inevitable result of idolatry. So he stood at the entrance to the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me. Whoever is for Yahweh, come to me." And all the Israelites rallied to him. Obviously, there were those among the people of Israel who had not gone over to the new calf worship, had remained loyal to Yahweh, the invisible God, with his strong moral demands. And then Moses said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side, go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor." In Exodus 22:20, we read among the laws of that section, "Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord must be destroyed." Moses now applies that law to Israel, using volunteers to carry out the executions. And the implication is that those who were actively responsible for the introduction of this idolatry, those who most willingly participated in that false worship, were the ones who were singled out for punishment, not the people in general. Brother, by the way, often means fellow Israelite in the Old Testament. The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. The smaller number is to be taken as evidence of a restricted judgment, perhaps an assault on the ringleaders and those guilty of the worst excesses. There would, in all likelihood, have been more than that participated in, or at least welcomed, the bull worship, but the judgment here is representative and exemplary, not a full-fledged judgment of everyone who deserved it. Then Moses said, "You have been set apart to the Lord today, for you were against your own sons and brothers, and he blessed you this day." The Levites were not free of the taint of sin, and so some of them were executed as well. So all the Levites, that phrase in verse 26 means contextually all who were not implicated in the crime. The NIV's "you have been set apart" is literally "you have been ordained." It was the Levites' zeal for the honor of the Lord, their willingness to count all their other relationships as unimportant in comparison to their relationship to God that accounted for their special calling and ministry in Israel. Jesus would say a similar thing, remember, about being his disciple. "Unless you are willing to hate your father and mother, brother and sister, and so on, you cannot be my disciple." To this point in the narrative, there had been no setting apart of the tribe of Levi for its priestly role. The next day, Moses said to the people, "You have committed a great sin, but now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Once again, Moses does not excuse, minimize, or extenuate Israel's sin. He knows that forgiveness is absolutely necessary. Instead, he promises to plead on their behalf. Make atonement, interestingly, in this case, does not mean to offer a sacrifice, but as we will see, to offer intercessory prayer on their behalf, like the prayer Moses had already offered on the top of the mountain, as we read back in verses 11 through 13. So Moses went back to the Lord. Apparently he reascended Mount Sinai and said, "Oh, what a great sin these people have committed. They have made themselves gods of gold. But now please forgive their sin. But if not, then blot me out of the book you have written." The book you have written suggests something like the New Testament's book of life, the register of the righteous, those who are saved. In that case, Moses would be saying something like what Paul says at the beginning of Romans chapter 9 about wishing himself accursed for the sake of his countrymen. The Lord replied to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book." In this case, the offer Moses makes is refused. The individual sinner must answer for his own sin. Moses cannot atone for the sin of another, and that fact, of course, opens up the way to the expectation of the coming of someone who could atone for the sins of others. So the Lord promises that he will lead, continue to lead, and continue to provide for his people. He will take them to the promised land, but he will reserve punishment for those who have betrayed him so defiantly. He'll not destroy the entire people here at the mountain, as he had threatened to do at first, but things will never be the same either. This is not the first, it will not be the last time Israel demonstrates her lack of faith in the Lord. And for this and for other instances of such faithlessness, this generation would not see the promised land in either respect. Either Canaan, when Israel entered the land some 40 years later, she will leave behind this generation of Israel in the wilderness, nor the eternal country, of which Canaan was a sign and seal, as the author of the letter to the Hebrews says so bluntly in his chapter 4. They did not enter the rest of God, that same rest that we are looking to enter ourselves. The point is that Israel was not acting out of character when she was worshiping the golden bull at the foot of the mountain. She was, in fact, reverting to form. Israel dancing before this idol is the true, the authentic Israel. "Now go, lead the people to the place I spoke of, and my angel will go before you. However, when the time comes for me to punish, I will punish them for their sin." And the Lord struck the people with a plague because of what they did with the calf Aaron had made. The question about that last verse is whether this is another exemplary punishment, a further scourge inflicted upon the people at that time by the Lord, or a reference to the later punishment referred to in the previous verse. In any case, the question or the chapter ends with many important questions unanswered. What will Yahweh do? What is Israel's future to be? What is to become of the broken tablets and the covenant they represent? And, of course, the chapter ends in a summary form with blaming once again both the people and Aaron. Now, among the other fundamental perspectives that are presented or illustrated in this narrative of Israel and the golden bull are those regarding sin and the divine wrath that is visited upon it. The narrative we read this evening primarily concerns the aftermath of Israel's sin, but it includes a commentary on it as well. Think, for example, of the nature of sin as expressed in the account of Israel running wild or letting loose in verse 25. There's a great deal of dismal human reality in that word. Think about sin as a letting loose or a breaking out. Is this not the case with sin in every way and always? Sin is a power within us that wants to break out, but is kept at least under some measure of control most of the time. It is a corrupting power, a degrading power, a destructive power, an ugliness, a foul, bitter, grasping urge that, when let loose, always results in inhuman, in bestial, in animal-like behavior. One never does what is good, what is beautiful, what is loving, what is life-giving to oneself or to others when he or she lets loose or breaks out. It's more like cutting open an abscess and watching the pus run out. When Israel let loose, they made an idol, the image of a bull, began to dance, probably in various stages of nakedness, dance around the statue she had made. When she let loose, she didn't do something wise, but something stupid. Not pure, but dirty. Not self-controlled, but wild. Not worthy of respect, she made herself a laughingstock. And if you stop and think about it, that's what always happens when sin lets loose or breaks out. To be sure, it doesn't always seem that way to everyone. A man can sin and be admired for it by others, and certainly that happens often. A man can sin and think himself clever and successful for having done so. And a great many people in our day indulge in revelry and think themselves the happier for having done so. And even there are so-called experts in our culture who will tell you that revelry is actually healthy for the human personality. But it's not so. The Bible plainly says it's not so, and the observation of human life confirms the Bible's teaching. Sin is invariably the breaking out or the letting loose of something low, unworthy, and destructive inside of us. And when sin lets loose, we are invariably diminished, and so is everyone around us. Sin does not elevate human life, it lowers it. It does not adorn it, it mars it. It does not bring it to its best and truest expression, it turns it into something unworthy, unadmirable, unhealthy. It does not purify it, it defiles it. It does not build it up, it disintegrates it. Christian theologians have expressed this point in their descriptions of sin, or in the terms that they have chosen to use to describe sin's essential feature. Some saw sin at its bottom as concupiscientia, or evil or corrupt desire. Take sin down to its essence, and that's what you get, evil desire. The Latin term concupiscentia. It's every manner of false desire that blooms when sin is let loose. No doubt the abiding popularity of fertility worship in the ancient Near East was due in large part to the sensual excitement that was part of that worship. But it's not hard to see, such desires lurking beneath, the same kind of desires lurking beneath so many of our sinful acts and sinful thoughts. Evil desire. One proof of which, of course, is how much of that evil desire we are jealous to guard and hide from the sight and the inspection of others. The other term, widely employed in Christian theology as a description of sin in its fundamental nature, is superbia, or pride, the enthronement of the self, the worship of the self instead of God. No doubt both ideas lie near the root and the bottom of every sort of sin. In Genesis, these two accents stand side by side. The desire to be like God, superbia, and the attractiveness of the fruit, concupiscientia, conspire to bring about the fall of man. In 1 John 2:16, we have sin described as the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes, concupiscentia, evil desire, and the pride of life, superbia. That's what sin is. And there is nothing attractive in that description. Nothing attractive, whether we're talking about the common, the ordinary sins of every human life, the little lies, the unkind remarks, the losing of our temper, the shaving of our taxable income on our return. Did you see in the paper last week the estimate that Americans owe some $1 trillion more in taxes than they pay? The lustful thoughts we indulge, the jealousy and envy that we feel toward others and sometimes express, the discontent, the complaining spirit, the laziness. Or whether we're talking about the larger sins that men and women commit, the big lies, the significant cheating, the promiscuity, the adultery, the trampling on someone else's life and welfare in order to get our way, the unwillingness to take up our responsibilities for a spouse or for our children or for our employees or for our company, the thefts that we so often commit, stealing from others, if by no other or in no other way than by not giving them what they ought to receive from us. And on the list runs. That's what sin is. We are what Israel was, dancing around that ridiculous statue of a bull. Whenever we sin, we are uncommonly stupid-looking, undignified, small, ungrateful, lustful, unworthy, unadmirable, just as they were. But we live in a sinful world that conspires with every one of us, all of us together, conspiring to forget what we really look like, how absurd, disgusting, corrupting our behavior is, how damaging to others, how supremely unworthy of our Maker. There would be an end to gay rights activism in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, if human beings just cared for the welfare of other human beings. But there'd be an end to a great deal of human sin if that were the case. We rub shoulders with other sinners like ourselves, and we agree to accept one another's behavior as normal rather than subnormal, as acceptable rather than what it is, unacceptable, as inevitable rather than what it actually is, the choices we make because we find holiness so difficult and sinful revelry such easy pleasure. And when we cannot any longer hide the fact that we did something unworthy and are ourselves unworthy as a result, disreputable, shameful, we do what Aaron did. We make excuses for ourselves. Aaron used both the excuses that we typically use, that all human beings typically use. First, he blamed others. It was the Israelites. It was their idea. They put pressure on me. I had to do something. If it hadn't been for them, none of this would have happened. Like Adam in Eden, he shifted the responsibility for his crime to someone else. Never admitted that had he been unwilling, had he stood his ground, none of this would have happened. And none of those people, those thousands of people, would be dead. Second, he took refuge in his helplessness and in the inevitability of what he did. There's a dark humor here at the end of verse 24. The narrator fully expects us to realize how bizarre Aaron's explanation really is, how silly it sounds. Did he expect anyone to believe that? Well, do we? Believe me, I hear a lot of excuses. People who cannot deny that they have done shameful things, will still try to persuade me that they weren't alone to blame, that there were factors that made their sin inevitable. Not really their fault. I know I did wrong, but we Northwesterners may remember a prominent U.S. senator from Oregon being accused of sexual harassment in the early 1990s. There's another instance, by the way, of the nature of sin. A desire inside that once let loose produces what is harmful and shameful and destructive. The senator's response was absolutely typical and absolutely revealing. He first denied the charges outright. He then attacked the credibility of his accusers. Next, he issued an extraordinary apology. Faced with charges that for years he had been kissing and groping his staff members, faced with such charges by 16 different women, the senator declared that he had never intended to make anyone feel uncomfortable. Still, he advised the media that he would seek professional help to see if his alleged behavior was related to his use of alcohol. In other words, the senator claimed that nothing happened. But in any case, he meant no harm by it, and regardless, he might have been drunk at the time and so unaware of the harm he was doing by the thing he did not do. We witnessed a similar evasion of responsibility this week in the case of the homosexual Episcopalian Bishop Gene Robinson, who was admitted into an alcohol rehab program. He didn't used to believe that alcoholism was a disease, he says, but now he does. The old public evasion was to condemn for only a few sins, or even just for one, and give everyone a pass for the others. So Dorothy Sayers once wrote, "A man may be greedy and selfish, spiteful, cruel, jealous, and unjust, violent and brutal, grasping and unscrupulous, and a liar, stubborn and arrogant, stupid, morose, and dead to every noble instinct, and still we are ready to say of him that he is not an immoral man." I'm reminded of a young man who once said to me with perfect simplicity, "I did not know there were seven deadly sins. Please tell me the names of the other six." Or, as may still be more common, certain civic virtue is used to excuse, at least in a conscience, sometimes horrific personal private corruption and betrayal. In her widely circulated book published in 1988, Sylvia Fraser tells of the tributes paid to her father at his funeral. He was a Christian man who didn't smoke or drink, who helped his wife with the grocery shopping, who never took the Lord's name in vain. He was polite. He was a good neighbor. He paid his bills punctually. But he also sexually molested his daughter from the time she was 4 to the time she was 12, and threatened his little girl, if she were to tell their secret to anyone, first with the loss of her toys, then with the killing of her kitty, and then with sending her away to an orphanage. Or think of the fine, upstanding Lutheran churchman, father and good neighbor, who turned out to be Wichita, Kansas's serial murderer. And of course, all of us are tempted immediately to take comfort in the fact that we've never murdered another human being or sexually molested a child, but of course, as Jesus teaches us, we have done those things or their moral equivalent times without number in our heart and in our life. And we have neglected to do the reverse of those things, love our neighbor as ourselves, still many more times than that. There is that in every one of us that we know is shameful and small and ugly and utterly unworthy of a human being. Our trifling virtues are not enough, not nearly enough, to set that evil aside. A point we prove to ourselves by doing our very best to keep so much of what is true about us, about our hearts, about our words, about our thoughts and attitudes, hidden away from the sight of everybody else. Integrity on one side of our character, Newman said, is no voucher for integrity on the other side. And we could go on further to say, a little bit of relatively easy virtue will convince no one who knew the facts that we should be given a pass for our inexcusable vice. And what happens on the individual personal level happens also on the level of culture and society as well. Grandiloquent excuses are now the order of the day in Western culture. Sociological and psychological determinism is now widely taught on the American university campus as a way of inoculating young Americans to the notion that they are responsible for the evil within, the small and petty lives that they live. We lack morally significant freedom. Our behavior is predestined in our genes, in our upbringing, in our environment. And of course, moral relativism means that no one is in a position to condemn the moral choices that I have made. He or she has no right. To do so is to imagine that there is some absolute standard to which we are all subject. G.K. Chesterton had something to say about these modern excuses and evasions as long ago as a century ago, long before they had reached the prevalency and the sophistication that they have attained in our day. Certain new theologians dispute original sin, which is the only part of Christian theology that can really be proved. The strongest saints and the strongest skeptics alike took positive evil as the starting point of their argument. If it be true, as it certainly is, that a man can feel exquisite happiness in skinning a cat, then the religious philosopher can only draw one of two deductions. He must either deny the existence of God, as all atheists do. A real God, a personal God, would not make a world like this with so much evil in it. Or he must deny the present union between God and man, as all Christians do, that man has fallen and is a sinner and has not yet been recovered to true goodness. The new theologians, on the other hand, seem to think it a highly rational solution to deny the cat. But of course, such evasions work only for some time and only for some people. Everyone, at least some of the time, most of us all of the time in some respects, know that right and wrong exist, and we make our judgments accordingly. If we don't condemn a person for pornography or promiscuity or adultery or even cheating on one's taxes, for who can dictate morals to someone else, they will nevertheless sternly condemn people for smoking or for other forms of air pollution, or for sexism or religious bigotry. And the excuses offered by either class of sinners for those people condemned for all of those sins are just like the excuses offered by everybody else. Pathetic, selfish, contradictory, unconvincing. Now, the old Christian writers used to ring the changes on the foul, bitter, loathsome nature and fruit of sin. I have classic works of this type on my shelf from the Puritans. Ralph Venning's The Plague of Plagues. John Owen's The Nature, Power, Deceit, and Prevalency of the Remainders of Indwelling Sin in Believers. And of course, what are John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress and The Holy War but extensive studies in the dismal realities of sin? In his letters to Malcolm, C.S. Lewis writes, "I've been reading Alexander White. He brought me violently face to face with a characteristic of Puritanism which I had almost forgotten. For him, one essential symptom of the regenerate life is a permanent and permanently horrified perception of one's natural and, it seems, unalterable corruption. The true Christian's nostril is to be continually attentive to the inner cesspool." But we hear very little of this anymore in our culture. And Christians are hearing little of it in their churches. They're not made to see any longer what lies beneath and what ugliness surfaces when pride and desire are let loose. They're not being hunted out of their excuses, their extenuations, their mitigations, and forced to face themselves in the cold light of day. They're not being educated in the subtleties of the heart, put on guard against the 1,001 deceptions that people perpetrate against themselves in an effort to avoid facing the truth about themselves and their behavior, and in particular, in an effort not to judge themselves according to God's judgment, but rather according to their own and the judgment of others. The two standards, of course, are wildly different from one another. And Paul warns us outright, they who judge themselves by themselves are not wise. And the problem is that when people hear nothing about these things, when they're not trained to see their sin for what it is, the disgusting, repulsive, destructive, and deadly thing that it is, they come to accounts of the ferocity of the Lord's judgment on such sins, such as we read tonight in verses 27 to 29 and again in verses 34 and 35, and they're taken aback. The punishment seems altogether too severe, too harsh. And the reason is that they have no longer any sense of the holiness of God or the viciousness or the stupidity of human sin. We lose those things very easily. We get them back only with great difficulty. But if we can't take seriously God's wrath against our sin, then inevitably, in time, we will find that the cross makes no sense to us either. For what is the cross but terrible, terrible punishment borne by someone else in our place? And that's why it is so dangerous for the church to forget the importance of convincing its people over and over again of the nature of sin, the enormity of our guilt before God, and making us realize how personally unworthy we are of hunting us out of our excuses and our evasions, and of holding our noses to the stench until we are sure that nothing is so necessary in all the world but that we should find forgiveness from God, and nothing so wonderful as the hope that someday, somehow, we shall be sinless ourselves, just like Jesus Christ. For that reason, we're wise to pause whenever we're given the opportunity, whether in the pages of God's holy word or in the observation of life, to reckon with the true nature and character of human sin. And once we have become ourselves again, thoroughly disgusted with it and afraid of it, imagine what God must think of it, who is holiness himself, whose eyes are too pure to behold this behavior, and against whom all of these sins, all of them, sins of thought, word, and deed, each one is being committed. Amen.